I'm Lister Sinclair, and tonight we continue our series of programs marking the 30th anniversary of Ideas. An annual highlight of each Ideas season is the CBC Massey Lectures. On Monday nights this spring, we're looking at the Massey Lecturers of the past 10 years. Each lecture series is condensed into a one-hour program. Tonight, we'll hear the Massey Lectures of 1988. Here's how I introduced them. On Ideas, the 1988 Massey Lectures about media, propaganda, and democracy, given by Noam Chomsky, Institute Professor in the Departments of Philosophy and Linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Boston. Professor Chomsky is an internationally renowned scholar, the leading theorist in the field of structural linguistics, and the author of some 30 books, both technical books in the field of linguistics and books addressed to a general audience, which examine political issues, focusing especially on the place of the United States in international affairs. He is particularly concerned with what Americans find out through their mass media, more properly called, in Professor Chomsky's view, the elite media. His approach to this question involves a massive amount of research. His books are noted for the mountain of data they contain. Throughout his work, Professor Chomsky has based his conclusions on a close analysis of specific cases, but his real interest is in the larger issues that the specific cases point to. What are the enduring institutional characteristics of our media system, the system we call the free press, and how do those characteristics affect what we think we know? The philosopher and theologian Reinhold Niebuhr concluded that ordinary people were hardly capable of understanding the world or drawing reasonable conclusions without being subjected to a set of what he called necessary illusions, what we'd call propaganda, constructed by the intellectual elites. The system for managing this has turned out to be the mass media. The title of the 1988 Massey Lectures is Necessary Illusions. Noam Chomsky.
Let me begin with a report in a church-based Latin American journal, Dateline, São Paulo, Brazil. The headline reads, Brazilian Bishops Support Plan to Democratize Media. The report describes a proposal, which is now being debated in the Brazilian Constituent Assembly, that would open up Brazil's powerful and highly concentrated media to citizen participation. The concept of democratizing the media has no real meaning within the terms of political discourse in the United States. In fact, the phrase has a paradoxical or even vaguely subversive ring to it. Citizen participation would be considered an infringement on freedom of the press. It would be considered a blow struck against the independence of the media that would distort the mission that they have undertaken to inform the public without fear or favor. Now, that reaction merits some thought. Underlying it are beliefs as to how the media do function, and also as to how they should function within our democratic systems. There are also certain implicit conceptions of the nature of democracy. Let's have a look at these topics in turn. The standard image of media performance was expressed by Judge Gerfein in a decision in which he rejected efforts by the U.S. government to bar publication of the Pentagon Papers. In that decision, he said that we have a cantankerous press, an obstinate press, a ubiquitous press, and it must be suffered by those in authority in order to preserve the even greater values of freedom of expression and the right of the people to know. Columnist Anthony Lewis of the New York Times commented on this decision and pointed out that the media were not always as independent, vigilant, and defiant of authority as they are today. But, he says, in the Vietnam and Watergate eras, the media learned to exercise the power to root about in our national life, exposing what they deem right for exposure, without regard to external pressures. That, too, is a commonly held belief. There has been much debate about the media during this period, but it does not deal with the problem of democratizing the media and freeing them from the constraints of state and private power. Rather, the issue that is debated is whether the media have not exceeded proper bounds in escaping such constraints. The question is whether they have perhaps even threatened the existence of democratic institutions in their contentious and irresponsible defiance of authority. There was an important study on these topics by the Trilateral Commission in 1975. It was a study on what they called governability of democracies, and the commission, which is made up of elite elements from Japan, the United States, and Europe, the commission concluded that the media have become a notable new source of national power. This, they said, is one aspect of an excess of democracy that contributes to the reduction of governmental authority at home and a consequent decline in the influence of democracy abroad. This general crisis of democracy, the commission held, results from the efforts of previously marginalized sectors of the population to organize and to press their demands. By doing so, they create an overload that prevents the democratic process from functioning properly. The American commentator Samuel Huntington, a professor at Harvard University, pointed out that in earlier times, President Truman had been able to govern the country with the cooperation of a relatively small number of Wall Street lawyers and bankers. In this period, then, there was no crisis of democracy. But in the 1960s, the crisis developed and reached serious proportions. The Trilateral Commission study, therefore, urges more moderation in democracy to mitigate what they call the excess of democracy and thus overcome the crisis. Putting it in plain terms, the general public must be reduced to their traditional apathy and obedience and driven from the arena of political debate and action if democracy is to survive. This study reflects the perceptions and values of liberal elites from the United States, Europe, and Japan. It includes the leading figures of the Carter administration, President Carter himself, in fact. On the right, the perception is that democracy is threatened by the organizing efforts of those groups that are called the special interests. That's an interesting concept of contemporary political rhetoric. It refers to workers, farmers, women, youth, the elderly, the handicapped, ethnic minorities, in fact, to the general population. One should not be misled by Reagan's landslide electoral victories. In fact, Reagan won the votes of under a third of the electorate, and of the voters, a clear majority hoped that his legislative programs would not be enacted. Meanwhile, half the population continue to hold that the government is run by a few big interests looking out for themselves, as polls regularly show. The Reagan phenomena, in fact, may offer a kind of foretaste of where capitalist democracies are moving in general, with a number of crucial features: the elimination of labor unions, of independent media, of political associations, and more generally the elimination of forms of popular organization that interfere with domination of the state by concentrated private power. Well, let's return to the media, which are charged with having fanned the ominous flames of excess of democracy. The Trilateral Commission concludes, I'm now quoting them, that broader interests of society and government require that if journalists do not impose standards of professionalism upon themselves, then the alternative could well be regulation by the government to the end of restoring a balance between government and media. Two kinds of questions arise in connection with these vigorous debates about the media and democracy. The first are questions of fact, the second are questions of value. The basic question of fact is whether the media have indeed adopted an adversarial stance, perhaps with excessive zeal, whether in particular they undermine the defense of freedom in wartime and threaten free institutions by flagellating ourselves and those in power. If that turns out to be true as a matter of fact, we may then ask a further question: would it be proper to impose some external constraints to ensure that the media keep to the bounds of responsibility? Now, the question of fact, which is of course fundamental, is rarely argued. The case is assumed to have been proven. There are some, however, who have argued that the factual premises are simply false. Let's begin with the broadest claims. Let's have a look at the functioning of the so-called free market of ideas. There's an interesting study by Benjamin Ginsberg of the mobilization of popular opinion to promote state power, and after reviewing many features of this, he concludes that, I'm now quoting Ginsberg, he concludes that the marketplace of ideas built during the 19th and 20th centuries effectively disseminates the beliefs and ideas of the upper classes while subverting the ideological and cultural independence of the lower classes. Through the construction of this marketplace, Western governments forged firm and enduring links between socioeconomic position and ideological power. They therefore permitted upper classes to use each to buttress the other. In the United States in particular, the ability of the upper and middle classes to dominate the marketplace of ideas has generally allowed these strata to shape the entire society's perception of political reality and the range of realistic political and social possibilities. While Westerners usually equate the marketplace with freedom of opinion, the hidden hand of the market can be almost as potent an instrument of control as the iron fist of the state. Now, these conclusions have some initial plausibility on guided free market assumptions that are not particularly controversial. Segments of the media that can reach a substantial audience are major corporations, closely integrated with even larger conglomerates. Like other businesses, they sell a product to buyers. The market to which they sell is advertisers, and the product is audiences, with a bias towards more wealthy audiences, which improve advertising rates. So, in effect, the media are major corporations selling privileged audiences to other businesses. It would hardly come as a surprise if the picture of the world they present were to reflect the perspectives and the interests of the sellers, the buyers, and the product. Furthermore, those who occupy managerial positions in the media or gain status within them as commentators belong to the same privileged elites, and it would be reasonable to expect that they would share the perceptions, aspirations, and attitudes of their associates. These reflect their own class interests as well. Journalists entering the system are unlikely to make their way unless they conform to these ideological pressures. Generally, they conform by internalizing the values. It's not easy to say one thing and believe another, and those who fail to conform will tend to be weeded out by familiar mechanisms. There are many other factors that induce the media to conform to the requirements of the state corporate nexus. To confront power is costly and difficult. High standards of evidence and argument are imposed, and critical analysis will naturally not be welcomed by those who are in a position to react vigorously and to determine the array of rewards and punishments. Conformity to a patriotic agenda, in contrast, imposes no such costs. Charges against official enemies barely require substantiation. No argument is demanded for a condemnation of Iran or Libya for state-supported terrorism. Discussion of the prominent, arguably the dominant role of the United States and its clients in organizing and conducting this plague of the modern era, that elicits only horror and contempt, and evidence, however compelling, is dismissed as irrelevant. As a matter of course, the media and the intellectual journals either praise the United States for dedicating itself to the struggle for democracy in Nicaragua, or they criticize it for the means it has employed to pursue this laudable objective. A challenge to the underlying patriotic assumption is virtually unthinkable within the mainstream, and if such a challenge were permitted expression, it would be dismissed as a variety of ideological fanaticism and absurdity, even if it were backed by overwhelming evidence. Not a very difficult task in this case. Case by case, we find that conformity is the easy way. It's a path to privilege and prestige. Dissidence carries personal costs. These costs may be severe, even in a society that lacks such means of control as death squads, psychiatric prisons, or extermination camps. The very structure of the media is designed to induce conformity to established doctrine. In a 3-minute stretch between commercials, or in 700 words, it's impossible to present unfamiliar thoughts or surprising conclusions with the argument and the evidence that's needed to give them some credibility. Journalists often meet a high standard of professionalism in their work. They exhibit courage, integrity, and enterprise. And this includes many of those who report for media that adhere closely to the predictions of the propaganda model. There's no contradiction here. What is at issue is not the honesty of the opinions expressed or the integrity of those who seek the facts. Rather, what is at issue is the choice of topics, the range of opinion permitted expression, the unquestioned premises, and the general framework that's imposed for the presentation of a certain view of the world. In accordance with these conceptions, there's no infringement on democracy if a few corporations control the information system. In fact, that is the essence of democracy. In the annals of the American Academy of Political and Social Science, a prestigious U.S. journal, the leading figure of the public relations industry, Edward Bernays, explained back in the 1940s that the very essence of a democratic process is the freedom to persuade and suggest, what he calls the engineering of consent. He goes on to say, a leader frequently cannot wait for the people to arrive at even general understanding. Democratic leaders must play their part in engineering consent to socially constructive goals and values. If the freedom to persuade happens to be concentrated in a few hands, as it obviously is, we must recognize that that's the nature of a free society. Similar ideas are standard across the political spectrum. The dean of U.S. journalists, Walter Lippmann, observed that what he called the manufacture of consent has become, quote, a self-conscious art and a regular organ of popular government. He felt that this was quite appropriate because, in his words, the common interests very largely elude public opinion entirely and can be managed only by a specialized class whose personal interests reach beyond the locality. Lippmann was writing shortly after World War I. At that time, the liberal intellectual community was much impressed with their success in serving as, quote, the faithful and helpful interpreters of what seems to be one of the greatest enterprises ever undertaken by an American president. The enterprise was Woodrow Wilson's interpretation of his electoral mandate for peace without victory as the occasion for pursuing victory without peace. In this, he was assisted by the liberal intellectuals, who later praised themselves in their words for having imposed their will upon a reluctant or indifferent majority. After World War II, as the ignorant public reverted to their slothful pacifism at a time when elites understood that we must mobilize for renewed global conflict, historian Thomas Bailey wrote that, quote, because the masses are notoriously short-sighted and generally cannot see danger until it is at their throats, our statesmen are forced to deceive them into an awareness of their own long-run interests. Deception of the people may become increasingly necessary unless we are willing to give our leaders in Washington a freer hand. Across the political spectrum, the fact that the voice of the people is heard in democratic societies is considered a problem to be overcome. The problem must be overcome by ensuring somehow that the public voice speaks the right words. The general conception is that leaders control us, not that we control them. If the population is out of control and propaganda doesn't work, then the state is forced underground to clandestine operations and secret wars. In the dependencies, we may turn to violence to restore democracy. At home, more subtle means are required. The manufacture of consent, deceiving the stupid masses with necessary illusions, covert operations, while the media and Congress pretend not to see until it all becomes too obvious to be suppressed. At that point, we shift to the phase of damage control to ensure that public attention is diverted to overzealous patriots or personality defects of leaders who have strayed from our noble commitments. The task of the free press in such circumstances is to take the proceedings seriously and to describe them as a tribute to the soundness of our self-correcting institutions.
Internationally acclaimed linguist and political activist Noam Chomsky from the 1988 CVC Massey Lectures. The title of the lectures is Necessary Illusions, Thought Control in Democratic Societies.
The model of media as corporate monopoly is the natural system for capitalist democracy. It has accordingly reached its highest form in the most advanced of these societies, particularly the United States, where public radio and television are limited in scope and elements of the radical democratic model exist only at the margins in listener-supported radio or the alternative or local press. Other Western democracies are generally a few steps behind in these respects. Most have not yet achieved the U.S. system of one political party with two factions controlled by shifting segments of the business community. Rather, they still retain parties based on working people and the poor, and to some extent representing their interests. But these are declining, along with cultural institutions that sustain different values and concerns, and along with organizational forms that provide isolated individuals with the means to think and to act outside the framework imposed by private power. The global policy goes under the name of containment. The manufacture of consent at home is its domestic counterpart. The two policies are, in fact, closely intertwined, since the domestic population must be mobilized to pay the costs of containment, and these costs may be severe, both material and moral costs. The rhetoric of containment is designed to give a defensive cast to the project of global management, and it therefore serves as part of the domestic system of thought control. It's rather remarkable that the terminology is so easily adopted given the questions that it begs. The underlying assumption is that there's a stable international order that the United States must defend. The general contours of this international order were developed by U.S. planners during and after World War II. They recognized the extraordinary scale of U.S. power, and they proposed to construct the global system that the United States would dominate and within which U.S. business interests would thrive. As much of the world as possible was to constitute what they called a grand area, and that grand area would be subordinated to the needs of the American economy. Within the grand area, other capitalist societies would be encouraged to develop, but without the kinds of protective devices that would interfere with U.S. prerogatives. In particular, only the United States would be permitted to dominate regional systems. The United States moved to take effective control over world energy production, and it organized a world system in which the various components would fulfill their functions within the overall framework of order managed by the United States, as Henry Kissinger was later to explain. Establishment of grand area principles abroad and necessary illusions at home does not simply await the hidden hand of the market. At home, the state has often employed force to curb dissent, and there have been regular campaigns by business to control the public mind and suppress challenges to private power when implicit controls do not suffice. The ideology of anti-communism has generally served this purpose since World War I. In earlier years, we were defending ourselves from other evil forces, the Huns, the British, the Spanish, the Mexicans, the Canadian Papists, and the merciless Indian savages, as they are called in the Declaration of Independence. But since the Bolshevik Revolution, and particularly in the era of bipolar world power that emerged from the ashes of World War II, a more credible enemy has been the monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that seeks to subvert our noble endeavors, in John F. Kennedy's phrase, Ronald Reagan's evil empire. Operations of domestic thought control are commonly undertaken in the wake of wars and other crises. The reason is that these tend to encourage the so-called crisis of democracy, that is, the persistent fear of privileged elites, and that requires measures to reverse the thrust of popular democracy that threatens established power. Wilson's Red Scare served the purpose after World War I, and the pattern was reenacted when World War II ended. The Vietnam War and the popular movements of the 1960s elicited similar concerns. The inhabitants of enemy territory at home had to be controlled and suppressed so as to restore the ability of U.S. corporations to compete in the more diverse world market by reducing real wages and welfare benefits and weakening working class organization. Young people in particular had to be convinced that they must be concerned only for themselves, that they must share in a culture of narcissism. Other newly mobilized sectors of the special interests also had to be restrained or dissolved. These tasks sometimes required a degree of force, as we learn from the programs of the FBI, to undermine the ethnic movements and the other elements of the rising dissident culture by instigating violence or sometimes the direct exercise of violence and by other means of intimidation and harassment. Another task was to overcome the dread Vietnam syndrome that impeded the resort to forceful means to control the dependencies. Commentary editor Norman Podhoretz explained that the task was to overcome what he called the sickly inhibitions against the use of military force that developed in revulsion against the Indochina wars. This problem was resolved, he hoped, in the glorious conquest of Grenada, when 6,000 elite troops succeeded in overcoming the resistance of several dozen Cubans and some Grenadian militiamen, winning 8,000 medals of honor for their prowess. The mechanisms by which a more satisfactory version of history was established have been reviewed elsewhere, but a few words are in order as to their remarkable success. By 1977, President Jimmy Carter was able to explain in a news conference that we have no need to apologize or to castigate ourselves or to assume the status of culpability, and we do not owe a debt. The reason, he said, is because our intentions were to defend the freedom of the South Vietnamese and because the destruction was mutual. That pronouncement passed without comment to my knowledge, apparently being considered as quite reasonable. It is beyond imagining in responsible circles that the United States might have some culpability for mass slaughter and for leaving three countries in ruins, or owe some debt to the millions of maimed and orphaned, or to the peasants who still die from exploding ordnance left from the U.S. assault. Meanwhile, the Pentagon, when asked whether there's any way to remove the hundreds of thousands of anti-personnel bomblets that kill children today in such areas as the Plain of Chars and Laos, comments helpfully that people should not live in these areas. They know the problem. The situation is quite different with regard to Afghanistan. In that case, press headlines read, "Mines put Afghans in peril on return. U.S. rebukes Soviets on Afghan mine clearing." The difference is that these are Soviet mines, so it's only natural for the United States to call for an international effort to provide the refugees with training and equipment to destroy or dismantle them and to denounce the Russians for their lack of cooperation in this worthy endeavor. The press responds with the usual selective humanitarian zeal. Throughout the period of U.S. global hegemony, there has been no hesitation to resort to force if the welfare of U.S. elites is threatened by what top-level planning documents describe as the threat of nationalistic regimes that are responsive to popular demands, I'm quoting, for improvement in the low living standards of the masses and production for domestic needs, and that seek to control their own resources. To counter such threats, the top secret planning documents explain, the U.S. must encourage a political and economic climate conducive to private investment of both foreign and domestic capital. The means, it is frankly explained, must ultimately be force, because such policies somehow fail to gain much popular support and are constantly threatened by what are called subversive forces. If the media are to serve their societal purpose, such matters as these must be beyond the pale, remote from public awareness, and the massive evidence provided by the documentary record and evolving history must be consigned to dusty archives or marginal publications. We may speak in retrospect of blunders, misinterpretation, personal failings, even corruption and deceit on the part of leaders gone astray, but the study of institutions and how they function must be scrupulously ignored, apart from fringe elements or a relatively obscure scholarly literature. These results have been quite satisfactorily achieved.
On Ideas Tonight, we're listening to excerpts from the 1988 Massey Lectures by Noam Chomsky. His topic is Thought Control in Democratic Societies.
Fabrication of necessary illusions for social management is as old as history. But in the democratic system, the necessary illusions cannot be imposed by force. Rather, they must be instilled in the public mind by more subtle means. A totalitarian state can be satisfied with lesser degrees of allegiance to required truths. It is sufficient that people obey. What they think is a secondary concern. But in a democratic political order, there's always the danger that an independent thought might be translated into political action, so it is important to eliminate the threat at its root. Debate cannot be stilled, and indeed it should not be stilled in a properly functioning system of propaganda. The reason is that it has a system-reinforcing character if it is constrained within proper bounds. What is essential is to set the bounds firmly. Controversy may rage as long as it adheres to the presuppositions that define the elite consensus, and it should furthermore be encouraged within these bounds. That helps to establish these doctrines as the very condition of thinkable thought, and it reinforces the belief that freedom reigns. One crucial doctrine, standard throughout history, is that the state is adopting a defensive stance, resisting challenges to order and to its noble principles. Thus, the United States is invariably resisting aggression, sometimes what's called internal aggression. Accordingly, it's a logical impossibility that anyone should oppose U.S. aggression. That's a category that cannot exist. Westerners have no problem in perceiving the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan as brutal aggression. But the U.S. invasion of South Vietnam in the early 1960s cannot be perceived as such. True, U.S. forces were directly engaged in large-scale bombing and defoliation in an effort to drive the population into concentration camps where they could be, as we put it, protected from the enemy whom it was conceded they willingly support. True, a huge U.S. expeditionary force invaded and ravaged the country and later its neighbors, with the explicit aim of destroying what was clearly recognized to be the only mass-based political force and eliminating the danger of political settlement that was sought on all sides. But throughout, we were resisting aggression in our yearning for democracy. Similarly, in the case of Central America today, the United States is defending freedom in what are called the fledgling democracies and restoring democracy to Nicaragua. There's no problem of ensuring democracy in the U.S.-backed terror states of Central America, firmly under military rule, behind a thin civilian facade. We can assess the seriousness of the concern by turning to the results of a controlled experiment that history obligingly constructed. Just as the free press was consumed with rage over the aggressiveness of the violent communist totalitarians in Central America, with major stories and angry commentary, our client State of Israel launched another series of its periodic operations in Lebanon. The Israeli operations included bombing of Palestinian refugee camps and Lebanese towns and villages with large-scale destruction, dozens of people killed and many wounded, including many civilians. All of this was barely reported, and there was no noticeable reaction. The absence of comment or even serious reporting of the Israeli actions in Lebanon is perhaps understandable. These operations were, after all, rather muted by Israeli standards. They do not compare with the murderous Iron Fist operations in Lebanon in 1985, or the bombing of villages in the Bekaa Valley a year earlier, with 100 killed and 400 wounded, mostly civilians, including 150 children in a bombed-out schoolhouse in one raid. These were reported, but without affecting the elevated status of Israel. This tiny nation, symbol of human decency, as the editors of the New York Times described it, just at the height of the repression of the current Palestinian uprising, with beatings, killings, gassing, and collective punishment. Nicaragua, in contrast, is denied the right even to drive attacking forces out of its own territory. This is on the tacit assumption that no state has the right to defend itself from U.S. attack, another crucial doctrine that underlies responsible debate. I mentioned some of the ways of approaching the study of the media and evaluating models of media performance. One appropriate method is to consider the spectrum of opinion that is allowed expression. According to the propaganda model, one would expect the spectrum to be bounded by the elite consensus while encouraging tactical debate within it. Consider U.S. policy with regard to Nicaragua. That's probably elicited more controversy and impassioned rhetoric than any other single topic during the past several years. There is debate between the hawks on the one side and the doves on the other. The position of the hawks is expressed by a declaration of the State and Defense Departments on International Human Rights Day in December 1986. They asserted that in the American continent, there is no regime more barbaric and bloody, no regime that violates human rights in a manner more constant and permanent than the Sandinista regime. Similar sentiments are widely voiced in the media and the political system, and it follows that we should support the democratic resistance to communist terror. At the other extreme, media doves observe that Mr. Reagan's policy of supporting the Contras is a clear failure, so we should acquiesce in some negotiated regional settlement that would be enforced by Nicaragua's neighbors. That's Tom Wicker of the New York Times. Expressing the same thought, the editors of the Washington Post see the Contras as an imperfect instrument, so we must find other means to fit Nicaragua back into a Central American mode and impose reasonable conduct by a regional standard. Notice that regional arrangements need not be imposed on our Salvadoran and Guatemalan friends, who have slaughtered perhaps 150,000 people during this period, or on our clients in Honduras, who kill fewer outright, but have left hundreds of thousands to starve to death while the country exports food for the profit of agribusiness. Their countries already conform to the Central American mode of repression, exploitation, and rule by privileged elements that accede to the demands of U.S. power, what we call democracy, so even hideous atrocities are of no account, and they merit aid and support, with occasional expressions of regret if the terror, torture, and mutilation become too visible to ignore. By 1986, the Contra option was opposed by 80% of American leaders, polls report. The propaganda model would therefore predict debate over Contra aid, but near unanimity in opposition to the Sandinistas. To test the hypothesis, consider the period of maximum intensity of debate over Nicaragua policy, the first 3 months of 1986, when attention was focused on the issue of Contra aid. During these months, the New York Times and the Washington Post, the two major national newspapers, they ran no less than 85 opinion columns on the matter. That includes their regular columnists. As expected, they were divided over Contra aid. But of the 85 columns, all 85 were critical of the Sandinistas, the vast majority harshly so. Thus, 100% conformity was achieved on the major issue. It's not that more sympathetic voices are lacking in the mainstream. There are many who would easily qualify for admission to the debate if they had the right things to say. This includes Latin American scholars whose opinion pieces are regularly rejected by the press, or the charitable development agency Oxfam, with long experience in the region, which found Nicaragua's record to be exceptional among the 76 developing countries in which it works, in the commitment of the political leadership to improving the condition of the people and encouraging their active participation in the development process. Like Arevalo and Arbenz in Guatemala, Allende in Chile, and many others, Nicaragua was perceived as a rotten apple that might infect the barrel, a virus that might infect others, a cancer that might spread. This is the terminology that is constantly used by planners when they contemplate the dread prospect of independent development geared to domestic needs. The real fear was expressed by Secretary of State Shultz in March 1986. He warned that if the Sandinistas succeed in consolidating their power, then all the countries in Latin America, who all face serious internal economic problems, will see radical forces emboldened to exploit these problems. His words. It is therefore necessary to destroy the virus and inoculate the surrounding regions by terror. That's a persistent feature of U.S. foreign policy, but these truths, too, lie far beyond expression in the media.
That was Noam Chomsky, professor of linguistics and philosophy at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. The title of his 1988 Massey Lectures is Necessary Illusions: Thought Control in Democratic Societies.
Many of our prominent newspapers have become almost agents or adjuncts of the government. They do not contest or even raise questions about government policy. This is Senator William Fulbright speaking in the United States Senate hearings on government and the media in 1966. These remarks are not precisely accurate. The media do contest and raise questions about government policy, but almost exclusively within the framework determined by the essentially shared interests of state and corporate power. Discussion outside these boundaries is rare, and it's the goals themselves that remain beyond challenge or even awareness. Most of the 181 New York Times stories on Nicaragua came from Washington, and they presented Reagan administration doctrine without challenge or analysis, including the laments about freedom fighters forced to fight with only boots and bandages against advanced Soviet armaments and Cuban-piloted helicopters, brutal repression in what George Shultz called this cancer right here on our landmass, Cuban troops swarming the streets of Managua by the scores in this terrorism sanctuary 2 days' drive from Texas, a second Libya, and so on, through the familiar litany of misrepresentation and outright lies. In the news columns, the Times tacitly accepted the Reaganite views, seeking out no others, thus contributing to a drastic narrowing for public debate. 4 times in the 181 stories, the Nicaraguan embassy was given a buried line or two, and in a few stories, the reporter added a background balance line. First priority in news reporting was given to the U.S. government. Ranking second were the U.S. proxy forces, the Contras. There were extensive reports of the concern of the Businessmen's Association, COSEP, harassment of the U.S.-funded journal La Prensa, and other abuses. With regard to Nicaragua, the typical pattern of media coverage was for the U.S. government propaganda services to concoct some charge, which the media would then prominently and uncritically relay. Occasionally, when the charges were seen to be outlandish, there might be a mild disclaimer on the inside pages. Often the charges persisted, even when acknowledged to be groundless or even sheer fabrication. The disgrace of the free press could hardly be more dramatic. It is worth stressing that far more is at issue here than dereliction of duty, incompetence, or service to power. The protection afforded state terrorists in the fledgling democracies provides a veil behind which they can pursue their atrocities with crucial U.S. support, while the indignant focus on far lesser abuses in Nicaragua has facilitated the Reagan programs of terror and economic warfare that reversed social and economic progress in Nicaragua and reduced the economy to ruins. The media were thus accomplices in an extraordinary outburst of violence and repression. Jack Spence observes that the obviously relevant pending World Court decision was not mentioned in the 171 New York Times news stories that preceded the World Court decision itself. The decision was on June 27, 1986. In this decision, the court condemned the United States for support for the Contras and ordered it to desist from these violations of international law and valid treaties and to pay reparations. The decision was reported, but it was dismissed as a minor annoyance. Its contents were suppressed or falsified, the World Court, not the United States, was portrayed as the criminal, and the rule of law was held to be inapplicable to the United States. Congress reacted by voting $100 million of military aid to implement what the court had called the unlawful use of force, while government officials commented happily that this is for real, this is a real war. Nicaragua brought the matter to the UN Security Council, where the United States vetoed a resolution calling on all states to observe international law. Nicaragua then turned to the General Assembly of the United Nations, which passed a resolution, 94-3, calling for compliance with the World Court ruling. 2 client states, Israel and El Salvador, joined the United States in opposition. The Security Council vote merited a brief note in the New York Times, the newspaper of record, but the General Assembly endorsement of it passed unmentioned. The Times UN correspondent preferred a story that day on overly high UN salaries. In November 1987, a year later, the General Assembly again called for full and immediate compliance with the World Court decision. This time, only Israel joined with the United States in opposing adherence to international law. This was not reported by the New York Times, the Washington Post, or the three TV networks. The reaction of the U.S. government and the media to world opinion merits further comment. The same UN session provides a number of interesting examples. While all attention was focused on the Washington summit in December 1987 and the INF Treaty, the UN voted on a series of disarmament resolutions. The General Assembly voted 154-1 with no abstentions, opposing the buildup of weapons in outer space. That resolution was clearly aimed at Reagan's Star Wars. It voted 135-1 against developing new weapons of mass destruction. In both cases, the United States was alone in opposition. The United States was joined by France in opposing a resolution passed 143-2 calling for a comprehensive test ban treaty. All of these votes were unreported and unmentioned in the New York Times review that was headlined "Setbacks to U.S. and Soviet at the United Nations." If the enemies of democracy are not communists, then they're terrorists. Still better, communist terrorists, or terrorists supported by international communism. The rise and decline of international terrorism in the 1980s provides much insight into the utility of interpretations. The Reagan administration deserves the credit for focusing attention on what Ronald Reagan and George Shultz call the evil scourge of terrorism, a plague spread by depraved opponents of civilization itself in a return to barbarism in the modern age. From its first days, the Reagan administration proclaimed that international terrorism would replace Carter's human rights crusade as the soul of our foreign policy. By 1985, terrorism in the Mideast Mediterranean region was selected as the top story of the year in an AP poll of editors and broadcasters, and concern reached a fever pitch in subsequent months. The U.S. bombing of Libya in April 1986 largely tamed the monster, and in the following years, the plague subsided to more manageable proportions as the Soviet Union and its clients retreated in the face of American courage and determination. This is the story according to the preferred account. In fact, the rise and decline of the plague has little relation to anything happening in the world, with one exception. Its rise coincided with the need to mobilize the U.S. population to support the Reaganite commitment to state power and violence. Kremlin-directed international terrorism was a natural device for the Reaganite public relations apparatus. The problem was to frighten the domestic population sufficiently so that they would bear the costs of programs to which they were opposed, while at the same time avoiding direct confrontation with the evil empire itself. That's far too dangerous for us. The solution to the dilemma was to concoct an array of little Satans, tentacles of the great Satan, poised to destroy us, but weak and defenseless, so they can be attacked with impunity. Our yearning for democracy is accompanied by a no less profound yearning for peace, and the media also face the task of historical engineering to establish this required truth. We therefore have phenomena called peace missions and the peace process. These are terms that apply to whatever the United States happens to be doing or advocating at some moment. A headline in the Los Angeles Times in January 1988 reads as follows: "Latin Peace Trip by Shultz Planned." The subheading describes the contents of the peace trip. Mission would be last-ditch effort to defuse opposition on contra-aid. The article quotes administration officials who describe the peace mission as the only way to save contra-aid in the face of growing congressional opposition. In plain English, the peace mission is a last-ditch effort to block peace and to mobilize Congress for what the World Court called the unlawful use of force, now that Washington and its loyal media had succeeded in completely dismantling the unwanted Central American peace plan. The Los Angeles Times described these renewed administration efforts to build support for the resumption of U.S. military aid to Nicaragua's Contras under the headline, "Schultz will try to revive Latin peace process." In short, war is peace. Throughout these lectures, I have been discussing some of the means of thought control and the reasons why these measures gain such prominence in democratic systems in which the general population cannot be driven from the political arena by force. The discussion may leave the impression that the system is all-powerful, but that is very far from true. People have significant capacities to resist, and sometimes do, with great effect. Take the case of the Western-backed slaughter in Timor. The media suppressed the terrible events and the complicity of their own governments, but the story nevertheless did finally break through, reaching segments of the public and even Congress. This was the achievement of a few dedicated young people, literally about half a dozen, people whose names will not be known to history, as is generally true of significant actors who have changed the world. Their efforts did not bring an end to the Indonesian terror or the Western support for it, but these efforts did mitigate the violence. Finally, as a result of their work, the Red Cross was allowed limited access, and in this and other ways, tens of thousands of lives were saved. There are very few people in the world who can claim to have achieved so much of human consequence, and the same is true of many other cases. The United States is a much more civilized and decent place than it was 25 years ago. The crisis of democracy that so terrifies elites is very real, and the effects on the society have been profound and extremely healthy with regard to a wide range of issues: racism, environmental concerns, feminism, intervention, and much else. There was no protest when John F. Kennedy sent the U.S. Air Force to attack the rural society of South Vietnam. In contrast, Ronald Reagan was driven underground to clandestine terror in Central America. The climate of opinion and concern had changed outside of elite circles, and the capacity of the state to exercise violence has been correspondingly reduced. The toll of Reaganite terror has been awesome. Tens of thousands of tortured and mutilated bodies, massive starvation and disease and destruction, hundreds of thousands of refugees, and much else. It would have been a great deal worse without the constraints imposed by an aroused population, which had found ways to escape the system of indoctrination and had found the courage and the honesty to act. These are no small achievements, again on the part of people whose names will be lost to history. There are ample opportunities to create a more humane and decent world if we choose to use them.
Noam Chomsky, from the 1988 CBC Massey Lectures, Necessary Illusions, Thought Control in Democratic Societies. Noam Chomsky is a professor of linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. We continue our look at the Massey Lectures of the past decade next Monday with experimental physicist Ursula Franklin. Her lectures are called The Real World of Technology. Ideas Tonight was edited by Paul Gorbold from the original 1988 production by Max Allen. Technical operations by Lorne Tulk. I'm Lister Sinclair. For more information on the Massey Lectures, you can visit our worldwide website at www.radio.cbc.ca. Our email address is ideas@toronto.cbc.ca, or you can write to us at Box 500, Station A, Toronto M5W1E6.